The following is a presentation of the Matt Talk Podcast Network.
Welcome to On the Mat. I am Kyle Klingman of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame Dan Gable Museum, joined by a man whose voicemail box is always full and not accepting messages at this time, Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com.
I don't know if that's true, Kyle.
I know.
Always. That's an absolute. I don't think it's always full, because I don't think it's full right now.
It's absolutely true for the last 10 times I've called you. Did you just clear out some space?
No.
And I didn't know about it?
I'll tell you the reason it's mostly full. It's because of Royce Alger voicemails that I have been reluctant to let go. Some pretty classic Royce Alger voicemails in there.
Can't you just take them off, transfer, put them on your computer somehow, and get them off your phone?
I probably could, but then they're not as readily available when I need a good laugh.
So you're telling me right now, if I call your phone, it will not be full.
Let's try it. You gonna try it right now?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how we do this on air right now to do it, but I know the last time I called you, it was absolutely full. So you have to clear some room off in order for that nickname not to be true anymore.
Okay. When's the last time you called and tried leaving me a voicemail,
Kyle? Well, I didn't try because I couldn't, because the voicemail box is full, so there's no way I could. That's the whole point of this nickname, is that it's full and I couldn't leave you a voice message. I had no options. Good thing for caller ID, or else you wouldn't even see it.
Sure.
So that's one of the perks of technology. I have some lost mail. I don't like lost mail. It's not fun when you have lost mail, but we have to go to our mailbag, and a piece of mail got stuck in the cracks, and we got to bring it out now.
Okay.
A month ago, Mike Ritchie emailed in. Mike Ritchie is the head wrestling coach at Southern Oregon University, a complete advocate for dual meet systems. So he had emailed in right after a podcast. We had just recorded it. So I said, we'll get it on next week. Well, I forgot. Sorry, Mike Ritchie, but we're getting to your mailbag now. And essentially what he's saying, in my opinion, he says, a way to make wrestling dual meets meaningful is to award 2 championship points for every dual meet victory, up to 20 points, motivating a college coach to get 10 wins a season. This would make the championship and every member of every team a part of the championships. Your thoughts when he says something like that?
A dual meet win equals 2 points for the national tournament.
Correct. In order to, I think, to get to the championship, and we would have to qualify with him on that. But essentially what he's saying, he elaborates, he says, the moment I really like is the kid that never sniffs the tournament, meaning the national tournament, but steps into a duel, and the team wins because he didn't give up bonus, and the team wins a trophy or gets into the top 10 because of those points his team needed to score during the season. Every wrestler is actually part of the show, even if they do not get to go.
So, just playing devil's advocate in my mind, like, you wrestle a Big Ten schedule, and you're going to run into Penn State, Iowa, Ohio State, Minnesota, Michigan, and you're probably not going to have as many dual meet wins as some, or dual meet points as some teams that you potentially beat.
That's true. But I think one of
and
the
potentially beat handily.
Correct. I think one of the cool parts about this is he's saying it's a formula, just like you would in soccer, where I think you get points accumulated and that helps you toward the final tally. But what's cool about this is, even though you are going to exclude some teams, you still have the individual national tournament that you can feed off of. And I don't know from Mike where he would put this in the season, if it would count as a championship, if it's a national duels concept. We would need to elaborate on that.
What do you think that would do for scheduling?
I think it would change it
Totally.
It would totally change the scheduling. You would absolutely have a new thinking of how you would schedule a dual meet. Because the Big Ten now, like you bring up, you probably would want to say, I don't know if I want to put Penn State on the schedule and Ohio State and Michigan and Iowa. If you have those four teams, you're probably looking at four losses if you're in a Big Ten schedule. And I don't know if any team had those four teams on the schedule this year. I'd have to look at that, but I'm sure that there's teams that have had that, and that's a gauntlet.
Mm-hmm.
Likely you're not coming out 1-3 at least. You're probably going 0-4 in that bad boy. So it's interesting because I do like the idea that it incentivizes a dual meet where you're paying attention to it.
Yeah.
Because if you're going in and say, hey, Iowa, Iowa State, you get 2 points if you win this, and it actually counts for something instead of just the great dual meet that you get 17-16 or Oklahoma State, Iowa, which under this scenario, they would have gotten the needed 20 points to get to the final tournament. But I think any way to explore how to get more value out of dual meets, I'm all in favor of having that conversation.
Totally.
Kudos to Mike Ritchie for sending that in. If you have other mailbag items, please get them to us. Also, what I want to talk about today is statistics. We've talked a lot about PDI. I'm a stat guy. You are too. I think we both like statistics. One of my favorite statistics is from someone who's no longer with us. Larry Quizzle from Boise State has passed away, I think, within the last year.
Only guy to beat TJ Williams.
Only guy.
In college.
And he also has the best statistic, my favorite statistic in all of wrestling. He won 12 consecutive NCAA championship matches over the course of two NCAA championships and did not win a championship. How do you do that? Well, you lose in the first round of the NCAA championships in 1999. You wrestle all the way back and you get third place. He's the only wrestler in the history of the NCAA tournament to lose a pigtail match and come all the way back and get third place. He went 8-1 at the 1999 NCAA championships. Then the next year went 4-0, got to the finals and lost in the finals to Matter, I believe, from Penn.
Yep. Brett Motter.
12 matches in a row and you don't have an NCAA championship. And I've always liked that stat. I like people that get third anyway. But thanks to Jason Bryant for coming up with this information. He's the stat guru, but he was doing a lot of work for the Matt Talk Online guide that he has.
Yeah, let's give that thing a plug.
Yeah, that thing's awesome. I bought mine already. I did buy it. So I'm proud that I got on board and typed in Gable for my $5 discount. Go to matttalkonline.com and order the preview guide. Thanks to Jason Bryant. But he's given me all this great information. So he went back and looked at who got third place and lost in the first round. 1996 was the first year that they allowed that to happen. It used to be that time where you had to lose to the champion, or if you lost in the first round, you couldn't come all the way back. So starting in 96, regardless of who you lost to, when it was, here are the people that have lost the first match of the tournament, came all the way back and got third. John Lang, Larry Quizzle, who is the king of it because he lost in the pigtail, the only person to do that. J.D. Bergman, Dustin Minotti, Donnie Vinson, A.J. Schopp, Zach Epperly, and Emery Parker. You are in a category by yourself. That's strong work.
Yeah, yeah. I knew J.D. Bergman was in that category. I remember him. What was that, 2006 in Oklahoma City?
I think that one was 2004. And then in 2006, here was the other stat that Jason brought up. Bergman almost did it twice. He lost in the first round in 2007, it says, wrestled to finish fourth. He was the only unseeded wrestler to get to third place in the expanded consolation era since 1996. He was awful close to having a double history there, getting third place, losing in the first round, coming all the way back to get third. And then I believe the next year, he made it all the way to the finals after getting fourth and got second to Dustin Fox from Northwestern in the heavyweight finals because he bumped up a weight class. That is my favorite stat. I love guys that get third, even if they lose in the semifinals. I've always like those guys that come back and get third place. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite stat? Does anything pop out to you as something that is like my third place losing in the first round, coming all the way back? Because it is tough to do when we bring up those guys and
I think
you come all the way back.
I think Penn State winning 16 straight semifinal matches is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Streak that's still going right now. You got to go back to Jimmy Gillibon losing to Corey Clark. I think is when it started, right?
For the streak?
Yeah. I think Gillibon lost to Clark in 2016, was it? 2015.
Probably 2015, wasn't it?
Let me look here.
Okay. And as we're talking about that streak, I don't know that I see that ending anytime soon. I think that they're going to have a nice streak, and I think they could get that to 20.
2015, St. Louis, Corey Clark beat Jimmy Gillibon in the semis, and Penn State has not lost a semifinal match since.
So 2016, won all the semifinals. 2017, won them all. 2018, won them all. And here we go into 2019, and they have an opportunity with what do you guys have for at least in the top two for Penn State?
Well,
how many guys are ranked in the top two?
Nick Lee is ranked, I think we got him second right now, at 141, and Nolf is number one. Vincenzo Joseph's number one at 165. Mark Hall, number one at 174. Shakur Rashid, number two at 184. Bo Nickel, number one at 197.
Man.
Anthony Kassar, number three at heavyweight.
So based on your rankings, they're all expected to win their semifinal matches and get there.
Except Kassar.
Third. Yep. Man, what a streak. So will it go to the 20? I think that's a storyline that needs to be developed. Will we see Penn State get to 20 semifinal wins in a row going back to 2015? That's incredible.
Yeah. Think about how hard it is to win one, right?
Yeah.
How hard it is for a team to get one guy from the semis to the finals, and they've won 16 straight.
That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. That is absolutely insane. Do we know what the second closest is? I haven't done any research on it.
I don't even know if that's a record. I don't know that it's a record, but you were asking me for a stat.
Yeah.
No, that's a stat.
I would think so. I can't imagine that not being the case unless you go back to some of those Iowa teams. But I think even those teams, you had a guy maybe slip through and losing the semis. I don't know. I'm just thinking off the top of my head of when it was possible. And you could go back to some of those early Oklahoma State years, maybe. I don't know. But that is a statistic that just makes you scratch your head when you think about it. Almost leaves you speechless on what that does and how dominant you are during that run. 16 in a row. We'll follow that with Penn State. See if they have an opportunity to go for 20 in a row here in 2019 in Pittsburgh. We want to make sure we get to a segment that we enjoy, and that is Casper's Corner. We haven't had this for about a month. We had a lot of conversation about Casper's Corner after the last one. Shane Sparks being one of those.
Sparks lit me up.
He did. He absolutely tore into you because you took the opposing view that he did, and he was livid. You put it on speakerphone right here, and I heard the 10-minute rant. I'm going a little embellishing here. It's probably 5 minutes, but it was a solid 5 minutes.
He was fired up, too, wasn't he?
He was. He said, you win it. He said, if you get there, you got to get it done. I don't care if you reached your full potential. And then didn't he backtrack
then
a little bit?
A week later,
okay,
he was backpedaling faster than an NFL defensive back.
Yeah. So where does he stand right now? Any idea?
I think he's more, maybe he's certainly more in the middle than he was at the beginning. It's an interesting question because it's not black and white. There are a lot of shades of gray in the middle. Repeat the question, Kyle.
Well, the question was, what would you rather have? Would you rather play second, knowing that you reached your full potential, or win an NCAA championship, knowing that you weren't your very best? And there's just no way of knowing that, which is why the question's so compelling, because how do you quantify any of these numerically because sure. you can't. It's just something internally. But it's a good question because I think that if you backtrack and you say, well, what if you got to the All-American round and didn't place, but you knew you got every ounce of yourself and you absolutely reached the absolute high bar that you got. Or maybe there's a guy that won two national championships and you can't luck into winning a national championship. That just doesn't happen. But maybe you could have teched your way through the tournament and you kept the matches close. I think that's the barometer there that we're saying is that did a guy like Damien, well, I think we used the example of Damien Hahn against Ryan Fulsis. Ryan Fulsis, who got second in 2004, he absolutely reaches the potential in getting second. There's no doubt about it. What was his overall record? 54 and 46 or something like that.
For his career.
So. Yeah, for his career when they announced it. That dude who hadn't even qualified for the national championships up to that point, he reached his max level in 2004 and got second place. He went above and beyond.
Well, I think the thing that's interesting about the question, too, is you don't know how close to reaching your potential you are. Like, that was not part of the equation, right? Am I 99% of the way to reaching my potential, or am I 59% of the way towards reaching my potential? My thinking with it was that if in my head I know that I cut corners and there are some stones that I left unturned, I'm probably always going to cut corners in my life because that success has masked what deficiencies I have in my process and how I go about things. And ultimately, in some way, shape, or form, it is going to catch up to me.
But I think what Shane would say, or at least in his initial rant, was you got second. Hey, if you can win that darn thing and get yourself a national championship, you go ahead and do it. It doesn't matter if maybe you were at 90% sure. capacity, you get on the stand and you become a legend for a lifetime. So I think it's...
We could spend an entire show talking about this question.
Because it almost is... The second place part is the hardest part because I don't think a lot of people think they reached their full potential when they got second place. Because if you're on the race stage, you got one more match to win. You think you can win it. You did enough. The question becomes, too, did you reach your full potential getting second place? Could you have done a little bit more and gotten there? Especially if you're in a close match, but you say, I maxed out. It's hard to, again, know how to quantify that and know how to rationalize
that. The other part of this thing that I thought about afterward, too, is just how many people are invested in your success. Coaches, friends, family, and they share your joy, they share your pain. And if you're on top of that podium, they're celebrating too. And if you're not, they're dealing with the heartache as well.
They sure are. What do you say we let Jacob Casper chime in on our question that we had from Casper's Corner last time? And let's get a new question from Casper in this week's edition of Casper's Corner. It is time for another popular segment of Casper's Corner. Jacob Casper, two-time Duke All-American. And we have to set this up first. Your last Casper's Corner got quite a bit of heat. We had some people arguing about it, saying that if you get a chance to win a championship, you should take it. And I think the interesting part about your question and how you set it up was that it was, would you rather get second place and reach your full potential? I think if you changed it to maybe eighth place and your full potential, it really changes the dynamic of the question. But you came in with, would you rather play second, reach your full potential, or win it and not realize your full potential? So there's been a lot of back and forth, Jacob. So great question. I don't know if you've gotten comments yourself, but it was a very thought-provoking question.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I saw where other people on other podcasts were talking about it, and people were tweeting at me what they thought. So I'm glad that it became interactive and got people talking. You know, at the end of the day, I think that's something that'll be really good for the sport. So hopefully we can keep it going.
Well, this is your platform. We don't know what you are going to ask. So the floor is yours, my dear sir. What is this week's question for Casper's Corner?
I know your hearts are beating. Everybody's worried. Everybody's wondering. there was a lot of talk after the Iowa-Okie State duel of what is the best direction for wrestling moving forward. So in this hypothetical, you know, if you won the lottery or inherited billions of dollars where money isn't an issue, what are the first couple things you would do to create a bigger, more sustainable future for the sport of wrestling?
Man, I like this because you changed the game on us and you didn't give us an either or option. So now we have to look at sustainability. I think from my vantage point, I think that we have to find a way to get the, not necessarily international level secure, but we have to get people to understand that there's a level past college. And I don't know how you tap into the youth wrestling movement and let them understand their heroes. But I don't think a lot of these youth wrestlers even know who many of the Olympic champions are. So from a historical standpoint, that's where I would start, is if you had money to invest in making sure that these youth wrestlers know who the heroes are, put these guys on a pedestal, spend whatever money it takes to get their name out there. And I think we're going to be a healthier sport if you're able to trickle down and have that knowledge. Andrew?
What ways would you go about that? How would you educate the kids? What do you think would be the best route?
I think somehow with social media, I think that's the platform right now. So whether it's an Instagram post, or I don't know if you start an Instagram account, but somehow get these guys out there so there's an awareness. And with all of these youth tournaments that take place, I think one of the best ways is to let them interact with them. Bring Kevin Jackson, Henry Cejudo, get them there over and over and over again. And it's not necessarily the guys that are current. You want to make sure they know about Kevin Jackson, Kenny Monday, Dan Gable, John Smith, so that they are part of the narrative. Because Andy and I have talked about this, and a separate question was, I felt that in certain circles, Ken Chertow is a bigger name than John Smith if you go to that youth level, because he did such a good job of marketing his camps. I don't think you'd necessarily see it that way in baseball. Derek Jeter, Alex Rodriguez, they're the big names. You have to know who they are, even if you're not a baseball fan. So I would invest a lot of money into making sure we know who those stars are. And I think that brings a lot of cohesiveness to the sport. Your thoughts?
I had a couple different ideas. You know, I think we're on the similar thought train of who you have to target. You have to target fans that are young, maybe even potentially new participants. I really had the idea, and I like the idea of doing like an animated type movie. I think those Disney movies with like Pixar and animation right now have been hot for like the last two decades. And if you could do a wrestling theme type movie where it could educate those kids about not only the sport of wrestling, but who some of those heroes are, and really just get a new fan base, a whole bunch of new families starting wrestling, it could be really, really good. Could pump a lot of new money into the sport. And then it would be really, really big to incentivize world titles in that international level, like you were saying. So the first thing I would do is probably get the animated movie going in order to increase participation and bring awareness to a younger age group so that the future looks stronger. I read somewhere that participation numbers were the highest after the movie Vision Quest for our country, which I thought was really, really interesting. And then after that, I would look to incentivize the world title and really get it onto, you know, some of the mainstream media so that those kids that, you know, are new fans now can watch some of their heroes compete for world titles that also have a lot of money at stake.
I think you're right on that, because if you go with the movie Space Jam, where Michael Jordan was in that, I think they did a remake. I remember Larry Bird saying that he gained more popularity from that movie. He got more recognition, people saying, hey, I saw you in Space Jam, than they did with him being in the Boston Celtics. So there's the power right there of some sort of an animated movie. I don't know what we would call it for wrestling, but I think you really are onto something there with some sort of a movie that gets kids watching it over and over and over again, because that's the repetition. That's how you learn names. So Larry Bird picked up an entire new fan base because of an animated movie, and I think that's the direction you'd like to go.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember my baby cousin had a Finding Nemo DVD that got played to death, and I was looking recently on Instagram, social media, like we were talking about, and I see UFC champions and people, and, you know, they have a million followers on Instagram, which is crazy. But then you look at some of these mainstream media people who are just on, you know, entertainment news and sometimes act, and they have 160 million, and you're just like, wow, why is there such a discrepancy? And you could just tap into that mainstream media and get more awareness and more eyes on the sport, I think people would appreciate it for what it is. And maybe, you know, start really investing in the sport as a whole and getting their kids and their families involved. And I think that could be really, really good for the sport.
Any thoughts, Andy?
I am taking a lot of money and I'm pouring it into fully funding some programs out west. USC, UCLA, San Diego State, Arizona, Washington, Washington State, Oregon, and protecting the territory that we have out there. You look at the state of California, we got 24, 25,000 participants at the high school level, and we have five Division I programs. And one of those five is Stanford, which, unless you're Kyle Klingman, you're not getting into Stanford. Jacob Casper can probably get into Stanford as well. He's a pretty bright guy, but I'm not getting into Stanford. I know that. So I'm looking out for the guys like me and trying to find more opportunities for the up-and-coming wrestlers out west. And also, that will benefit the programs like Arizona State, the five programs I mentioned in California, Oregon State, that are really strapped for, you know, one of the big challenges that those schools face is getting teams to come out and travel out to schedule home duels. They have a hard time getting home duels just because of the travel time and expense that's involved in it. So I think protecting what we have and growing what we have out west is critical for, I think, wrestling's long-term health at the college level. Also, it gives some of those young athletes out west something to look for and shoot for. After that, I'm looking down in the SEC and trying to get back what wrestling once had in the Southeastern Conference. We had Kevin Jackson on as our guest last week. Three of his first 3 years of college were at LSU. And then all of a sudden he's looking for an opportunity because LSU drops their program. And so trying to bring back those programs, strengthen those programs, and also, build upon what we have. Those are the first things that have been in my mind. Believe me, I've thought about what would I do if I won the Powerball jackpot, and I start thinking about programs like that where wrestling
would you endow scholarships? Would you endow coaching positions? How would you secure the future at those universities?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It would be, they'd all be endowed. You said money's not an issue, right?
Right.
We're gonna make sure that we spend it up front and secure a really sturdy foundation. Get some top-notch coaches in there as well to give the programs a chance to get off the ground and flourish in the beginning. I think, like I said, first and foremost, you would go to areas where wrestling is strong at the high school level, and then after that, to give you the best chance to succeed in the beginning, you know, to field a competitive team where, what is it? We're less than like 1% of high school athletes across the country have a shot to go Division I. Is that what it is? Something like that, I think. I think we need to bump that up where we're more competitive with other sports.
Jake, on that, when Andy's talking about that, you attended Duke. Do you feel like Duke is on solid footing? Are they going to have the program for years to come?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know, that's something that I was just going back and forth on in my mind, because I feel like if you put the money into it, then the university, is just never going to have to invest anything. And while they'll let you, you know, operate, I don't know if they're ever going to really back you and strongly push, you know, the program and push it to locals and really try to get that out there. I think instead they're just going to not do anything with it. Because if they were to cut it and reallocate those funds, it'd be more negative publicity. So it's kind of like the chicken and the egg question, right? Do you incentivize it and then hopefully universities see the benefit of doing it, or do you fund it at the lower level and then hopefully, with a solid footing, you're able to build off of that? It's kind of a difficult question, especially for smaller schools. As far as Duke personally, you know, we have a strong alumni group that's starting to back the sport more, or back the team more and more. So hopefully that can continue to grow and we can get to a place that we're long-term, really, really sturdy, and not only sturdy, but also getting to the point where we're on an equal playing field with other teams. You know, we have a strong enough footing that we're able to compete with those teams. But I really do like the idea of getting into the SEC and bringing back some of those teams as well as the Out West teams. I mean, it would be really cool to see LSU field a team again, and then Clemson for the ACC even, and bringing all these teams back. You have some conferences already that are established, and they're not not maximizing the potential, you know, with Mizzou and their conference. And just, it would be so cool to look at the NCAA tournament and see 170 different teams represented and all these different color combinations. And I think that would be a really, really cool thing. I actually like that idea a lot.
In some ways, we have to create a product where we can't be ignored, that it's so good that people can't ignore college wrestling or high school wrestling or special international wrestling. That's the million-dollar question, as you said. Where do you put your funding? So, compelling question. Quick question for you as we end our Casper's Corner segment. Who's the greatest Duke heavyweight, Conrad Dudziak or Jacob Casper?
You know, this is something that I think the guys on the team ask me a lot and stuff, too. At the end of the day, I just got to give it to Conrad. You know, he had the finals appearance, and, you know, I wasn't able to get past the semis 2 years in a row, so... Got to give it to Conrad just because he finished, you know, on the big stage, which is something I was never able to do.
Thanks for another.
Before we cut Jacob loose, one of the things in my mind is shortage of high level coaching. I've heard that a lot here in the last couple of weeks at the lower levels. How would we, you know, in your opinion, Jacob, in trying to grow the sport, how would we incentivize it to? You know, have more high level coaching at the youth level, at the youth levels, at the high school levels, at the scholastic levels, and on. What kind of things would you do there?
I don't necessarily think that there is a shortage of high level coaching. I do think that there is a discrepancy in where it's dispersed. If you look, there are geographic regions with, you know, multiple time national champs coaching at the high school level, all within a 15-mile radius of each other, and then you'll go to other areas and you'll have people that didn't even finish their high school careers that are coaching at the high school level. And I am a strong believer in your accomplishments don't dictate the type of coach you're going to be, but having that wealth of knowledge and that those types of resources so close for so many, you know, I grew up wrestling a lot in Northeast Ohio in the western part of PA, and everybody, it seemed like, was an All-American. It seemed like everybody was a national champ. Everybody wrestled at the college level. And then I go to other places to do camps and clinics, and, you know, there's nobody around for miles and miles and miles that have done any of those things. So I don't think it's necessarily that there is a shortage of coaches. I think they're just spread out and dispersed kind of, you know, sparsely. There's pockets here and there. And I think that if, you know, kind of like the Field of Dreams, right, if you'd build it, they would come. And if these programs would be willing to invest money, even at the college level, right? So say Clemson would start a program off and, you know, that they invest enough money in it that it's solid and that the coaching position is well paid, and they approach Casey Cunningham and they try to lure him away from Penn State. If the offer's tempting enough, that he's going to do it. If the room looks good, if the locker room's nice, if, you know, the pay's right for him, he wants to get down south and start something cool at Clemson. So I think the resources just have to be in place to kind of get those people out of the locations they're really tied down to and have their roots in.
And to your point, Alan Freed just said recently that he was third string in his area. I think there was Nate Carr for a while. There was the Jordans there in that area. So you're right. You can get a dense population where you have a ton of great coaches. And it's too bad that we can't get more of that. But I didn't even think about times where you don't even have a guy that probably made the state tournament leading the charge in some area that that doesn't have wrestling flourishing at this point. Jacob, we appreciate the time today. Another riveting edition of Casper's Corner. Can't wait for another edition. We look forward to seeing you in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for the NCAA Championships. Thank you, Jacob.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys.
That was another exhilarating edition of Casper's Corner. Before we get to our guest, which is three-time NCAA champion Nate Carr, we got so excited about all of the topics, we haven't even mentioned him yet. We have to make sure we talk about a record-setting team, Grandview University of Des Moines, Iowa. 8 NAIA wrestling championships in a row. And the only team that can beat Grandview at this point is Grandview.
That's pretty incredible. 219 points. They looked, what at one point in the tournament, I think they were like 28 and 2. And one of their two losses was a Grandview versus Grandview quarterfinal. So they had 12 All-Americans. They won by, I think, like 134 points or thereabouts. And as you mentioned, 8 straight national titles. That machine is running as efficiently as probably ever before. And good luck trying to catch them at this point, trying to run them down.
When people ask why, you were in Des Moines. Do you know why? Why are they this successful? I think part of it's Nick Mitchell. I just think he has a great formula. I think he's a outstanding coach, coached by Jim Miller at Wartburg. And I think he understands how to reach these guys. But like anything, there's a lot of pieces that go into it. And I think when you have athletic administrative support, which Grandview has, I think they want to, as a university, win championships. And when you have that backing, it makes it a lot more efficient to be able to win a championship.
Yeah, they got a lot of support internally there. And as you mentioned, Nick comes from the Wartburg system. And you ask why? Well, why has it worked for so long for Wartburg? There's probably a lot of parallels between the two programs. And then also just really the never be complacent type of attitude in there. They went, they have 6 guys in the finals and they only won 2 titles. Granted, they weren't going to win. They were going to take a loss in one of those because it was a Grandview versus Grandview final at 149. And I think Nick's answer to that question, when I asked him about that, I said, how weird is that? To have 2 guys on your roster battling for a national title. And they've had it before, 141 pounds. I think, about 4 or 5 years ago, they had, 2 guys going heads up, Brandon Wright and Gustavo Martinez. Nick's answer was telling. He said something along the lines of, every match we go into, we think we've got a shot to win. And we know that we're going to lose one of those in a match like that. We know one of our guys is going to lose. Which is pretty fascinating,
right?
That's
weird. I still haven't gotten over that. It's so foreign to me to think of a championship finals where you have 2 guys. And I guess it was kind of like 2016 with the Olympic trials with Ramos and Dennis. Yeah, it feels that way. And it's just awkward, I would think. But I'm not in that situation, but you want guys in there. And for those who don't know and are listening, you can qualify 12 wrestlers for the NAI wrestling championships, which is still strange to me, but history of that.
Yeah. So I got a chance to talk to Mike Mockles, the Missouri Valley coach, one of the veterans in the NAI scene. He's, I think, year 27 at Missouri Valley. And so he's seen NAIA wrestling through good and bad in terms of highs and lows for program numbers. They were down under 20 programs at one point here, like 20, 25 years ago, and trying to beef up their national tournament. They allowed teams to enter 12 wrestlers for the postseason, and you don't have to have a starter at every weight. You can enter multiple wrestlers at several weights. And so you'll see it. Grandview had a couple 125 pounders. They had a couple 149 pounders, a couple at 157 as well. And so it's just been something that they've done throughout the years. And one of the really cool things about what's going on in NAI wrestling right now is 5-6 years ago, the tournament was in Des Moines. They had 35 teams in the tournament. Next year, there's going to be upwards of 70. It's the fastest growing division in college wrestling. And I think it's probably not long before it will be the biggest division in college wrestling. I had a chance to talk to Menlo athletic director Keith Spataro, and he pretty much wrote the playbook for what programs are doing now and adding based on enrollment driven programs. It's really cool what's going on in terms of participation numbers at that level and program numbers at that level. And I think the quality of wrestling has certainly gotten a lot better here in recent years too.
What does it feel like for you when college wrestling program gets added? I know what it feels like when one gets dropped and it feels like a gut punch.
Yeah.
It feels more like a death to the family, but I love that feeling when I read that story and it says wrestling program added regardless of level. That's such a fun read to be able to see that, know that they're getting invested behind it. And it just builds momentum for the sport, regardless of level. And I think NAI really is, like, to your point, just building to that level. And it enhances the overall health of the sport.
Yeah. And the cool part is it's almost like, I don't want to say I take it for granted, but it's almost become the point where you see it so often now that it doesn't resonate quite the way it did. And that's good though, you know, that we're seeing it so frequently at the NAIA level in particular. And yeah, there's a lot of talk about, well, we're not adding enough Division I programs, but one of the things that's really cool is Division II is growing really quickly as well. And you're seeing Cal Baptist make the transition from D2 to D1. Utah Valley made the transition from D2 to D1. Maybe in some ways that's our gateway to growing numbers at the Division I level.
I think it could be. And then once we start getting some women's programs at the Division I level, I think again, we are in the best times right now for the sport. Enjoy it. And another guy we need to enjoy, we'll give him a plug just because he won an international tournament. Enjoy Jordan Burroughs. Enjoy what he's brought.
Yeah.
I don't know if we have another couple of years out of him. I know we have it through 2020, but take every opportunity you can to listen to this guy, to watch this guy, to enjoy this guy, because you will never see someone like Jordan Burroughs again. This guy is off the planet special. Take that chance because he just put himself in a good position to win another world championships by going to a ranking tournament and winning it.
And putting a 9-2 beating on Frank Chamizo.
Yeah. Who Chamizo came back and got a bronze. So enjoy him. We're going to enjoy another wrestler who is our guest today, Nate Carr. Do you think you could take Nate Carr down right now?
No.
You don't?
No.
I'd say the same thing. But we're going to go to Ames.
You and I together could do it, though?
No, I don't think so.
What about you standing?
I don't think so.
You standing behind him on your hands and knees and me pushing him backward.
If we the John Smith
takedown maneuver.
I don't feel good about what would happen once he gets up and he's chasing after us. He's got some serious yeah, foot speed even no at this doubt. Age. So I ain't messing with an Nate Carr. So let's go to Ames, Iowa and talk to a living legend. Our guest today is a living, breathing legend. Why is he a legend? He won 3 NCAA championships for Iowa State University. He won a bronze medal at the Olympic Games. He's a member of the National Wrestling Hall of Fame. Now he is the associate director of the Cyclone Regional Training Center. Nate Carr, how are you?
Oh, just fine. It's good to be with you guys today.
It's good to be with you, and it's good to know that you're back in Ames, Iowa. What's it feel like to be back in the great state of Iowa?
Well, yeah, definitely. It's good to be back in Iowa, and of course, Iowa State, there's a lot of different new buildings and new apartments all over the place, so it's a little different, but the wrestling is thriving, so that's good. The ISU is doing well, and I'm excited to be a part of that.
I was trying to think of your personal journey. You started in Pennsylvania, came to Ames. Yes. At some point, you went to West Virginia and then to Ohio. How many different states have you lived in?
I would say probably 4. Yeah.
4 different states?
Yes. So it's not that bad.
Yeah. How was your time in West Virginia?
It was good. You know, I know when I got there, they were ranked 19th in the country. And I remember talking to Coach Turnbull and just saying something like, you know, we have to say that we want to win a national championship. And when we started saying that, things started to change. Let alone we got some national champions as well. When I left, we were 6th in the country.
How did you end up at Iowa State? There's so many great stories about Harold Nichols and how he recruited people. He was the legendary coach at Iowa State. What was your personal recruiting story to get you to Iowa State from Harold Nichols?
Well, you know, again, Iowa was the first school to recruit me, Iowa University, Gable and Robinson. And Harold Nichols, after that, not too long after that, came into the picture. And, you know, what's interesting, you know, thinking about it, is that neither Gable nor Robinson came to my house. So when I connected with Nichols, he came to the house, you know, right away, came to the house. And then he even came one more time And it just happened to be at my sister's wedding. Two of my sisters got married on the same day, and Nichols came to the wedding. And so, you know, the other inside story is that I was leaning toward going to Iowa. You know, there was no doubt about that. My mom had a dream, and, you know, I was telling her, I said, you know, she said, you know, I had a dream that you went to Iowa State. And I was like, Mom, I respect that. You know, it is my decision, and I'm still going to go to Iowa. And then my mom had the dream again, and I was like, oh, that's it. It doesn't matter. I'm going to Iowa State. And so, and what a great choice that was for me. So,
so I want to back up before I get to the next question. You're telling me Harold Nichols came to your sister's wedding to recruit you?
He was, I think we had invited him to the wedding, but he came.
Okay. I've never heard of that recruiting ploy.
You know what? I'd really, you know, I always share the story that, you know, my mom had the dream, but yes, I actually have pictures with Nichols at the wedding. Yeah.
That's great. Now, what is it about the University of Iowa during that era? Because I've heard that from Alan Freed. I've heard Kerry Collott say it. Now I've heard you say it. I've heard Tim Krieger say it. They've all said, I wanted to go to the University of Iowa. What was it about being a Hawkeye that was so appealing during that era?
Well, just personally, for me, I know Jay Robinson did a good job. You know, he was contacting me a lot. I talked to Gable, and basically, I mean, they were the champs at the time, no doubt about that. And they, you know, I remember I flew to Iowa for a visit, and on that visit was all the top guys in the country. Selesky, Jim Farina was there, Kerber was there. There's like a bunch of us. And I remember Gable setting us down and pretty much saying something like this: gentlemen, if all of you come here to the University of Iowa, we will complete our dynasty. He was talking like that.
So, what? now that you look so, back,
I think just that there, yeah.
Would you have been a fit there? Would that have been good for you to go to Iowa?
You know, I really didn't think about it, but one of the things that Jay Robinson was doing is he was really showing me how successful Chris Campbell was. And, you know, and they were sending me a lot of things on Chris Campbell and how well he was doing. So that, you know, and it, you know, that attracted me. And pretty much I was definitely leaning that way.
Are you glad you ended up being a Cyclone? You won three.
Right. Well, here's another little story concerning that. When I decided to go to Iowa State, Jay Robinson was not too happy, and he actually, on the phone conversation, you know, basically said that you'll never win a national title, you'll never make an Olympic team, and he said something personal like, and I always, you know, I will always be coaching against you. So, and me and Jay are great friends now, of course, you know, but yeah, it was intense.
Did you take the same sentiment that Tim Krieger took, that whenever he wrestled a Hawkeye, he was going to take it out on him?
Right, yes.
You did?
Yeah, well, I just, you know, I didn't like losing, period, but definitely, you know, I made sure as much as I could that I was always ready to wrestle, you know, the Hawks, you know. So that's all. I mean, yes.
You wrestle.
I like the intensity. I like the crowd. It was, I mean, you know, lose or win, you know, you were ready to do battle.
You wrestled at 150. Jim Zaleski wrestled at 158. Why did you bump up to wrestle him?
Yeah, really didn't think about it. I basically, Nichols thought, you know, hey, just let's go up. So I actually made, it was like a late thought for him. He's like, you know what? Why don't you go up? So I actually made 150 and then went up. And so when I went out to the wrestle gym, of course, you know, I wasn't afraid, but he was definitely bigger than me. And I, yeah, he was just too much, just felt strong, big on top. And, you know, I remember watching the match and I was thinking, if I wrestle that guy again, he's not going to beat me. And it proved true. I mean, I wrestled him three times after that. I pinned him, and I don't even know if he took me down after that. So, in a match. But he definitely did in the dual meet, and I'll never forget a fan from Iowa coming up to me saying something just kind of rhymed, but she said something like, I think I got beat by 10 points, 12 points, I can't even remember, but she said, Nate from Iowa State, you wrestled great. So she was really giving it to me. And when she said that to me, I'll never forget it, Jim Zaleski was just a couple steps away from me. And I said, yeah, you know, I said, I lost tonight, but there's no doubt I'll win the national title. And then I said something like, right, Jim? And he was right there. He's like, just nodded his head. So.
All right, let's go back to 1981. Randy Lewis breaks his arm against Jim Gibbons, dislocates
man,
it, comes down to Dave Ozenbaugh. Dave Ozenbaugh gets the pin over Lou Bannock, and out of the screen, I see Nate Carr running as fast as he can and plows into Dave Ozenbaugh and absolutely mashes him. Chris Campbell comes from behind, does the same thing. I've never seen anyone run so fast. What were you thinking?
Dude, I was just excited. I mean, I wanted my teammates always to win. So I was really into my teammates doing well. And so that was my first passion, you know, that, you know, as a team, I wanted them to get those guys to do well. And when Ozenbaugh did that, I mean, it was just like a dream come true, you know, that we're beating the Hawks, you know, not to mention that Gable came from Iowa State. So we really had a passion to go after those guys. And I thought, you know, especially during my era, I thought we had the better teams. But, man, somehow the Hawks, they would just pull it out. You know, but that one time there, it definitely didn't happen. And then for Ozenbaugh to do that was just unbelievable. That crowd just went crazy. You know, and so did I. It was awesome.
There's never been a reaction like that. I've never seen a pick pile on a guy after a dual meet. It was like a basketball game when you hit a game-winning shot. The police had to get involved, had to get him off the pile. And I'm surprised Dave Ozenbaugh made that out alive.
Really? We were just so, you know, so excited. And then, you know, because Ozenbaugh really wasn't supposed to win, right?
Oh, he's getting crushed.
Yeah, right. So hence the excitement that he does like a roll or whatever, he just rolls on top of Bannock and pins him, and yeah, we win. And so it was just, yeah, he was the hero that night. I mean, and Jim Gibbons was ready. I remember Jim Gibbons getting ready for, you know, Randy Lewis. And, you know, the thing about, even when I was getting recruited, remember they sent pictures of Chris Campbell, they recruited me. Well, when I picked Iowa State, Chris Campbell left Iowa and came to Iowa State. So he was my coach anyway. So it really worked out well for me. But to tie it into Jim Gibbons getting ready for Randy Lewis, Chris Campbell had Jim Gibbons practicing a high crotch where he would hit it. As soon as he shot it and hit his knee, he would bounce off his knee, drive it at an angle to the opposite leg, and lift in the air, you know, so he could get the takedown, because Randy Lewis was just like a cat. You could throw him up in the air, man. That dude's coming back on his feet. And so, you know, Jim Gibbons was ready for that. And he must have did that shot that he hit on Randy Lewis hundreds of times. After practice, he had to drill that every day to get ready for Randy Lewis. And he did it, and Randy Lewis was so high in the air that when he was coming down, he posted on his hand to kind of catch his balance, but the impact was just too great.
So when you look back at that meet, a historic meet, and you have all of these moments that go into it, it didn't go the way anyone thought it would, especially with the injury. Is that I mean, of all the moments you've had, where does that stand as one of the great moments, that dual meet win over Iowa in 1981, where Dave Osmond pulls off the miracle?
Yeah, no, it's right up at the top, right at the top. I mean, it definitely serves as a big moment. You can see people captured it, you know, it's on film, it's in pictures. It's at the top. I mean, just a whole team coming together, and seeing basically a miracle happen.
And you were always a cheerleader for guys. You always were behind your team. Yeah. Was that something you always wanted to be part of and just be a cheerleader for the other guys on the Iowa State team?
Yeah, you know, especially when I started to do well, you know, my dream was always for my teammates to do well. And I remember wrestling matches where I was so into them winning that I mean, literally almost forgot that I had to wrestle. That I was so into them winning that, you know, at times I think it took away from my wrestling and my focus because I wanted them to win so bad. And to me, that's what it's about, to really have that passion for your teammates. And when you do that, I think the teams can do some great things when you're caring for the other guy. You know, it's almost like get over yourself and give yourself to your teammates.
Nate, you were lightning fast. You were a fast dude on the mat. Seriously, man, you're telling me that Bob Siddons, Gable's high school coach, who was a referee, actually told you to slow down because you were going too fast?
It's true. I was like, are you kidding me?
What did he say?
He said, Nate, slow down. You're moving too fast. Just right in the match. Right in the match.
What'd you do?
And Dave, no, I just kept wrestling. I just kind of blew it off, you know. And Dave Allen said one time he was refereeing a match. And, you know, he told me this story. He said he's right out there. He has a side judge, and the guy shoots on me. He said I just levitated in midair and was behind the guy before he knew it. And he actually asked the side judge, said, "Did you see him get behind him?" You know. So, yeah. Dave Allen told me that story.
You mean Mike Allen?
Oh, no, Mike Allen. I'm sorry.
Mike Allen.
Yeah.
When I think of fast, I think of you, but I also think of your other brothers. You had Jimmy Carr, who, let's talk about him for a sec, 17 years old, makes the 1972 Olympic team. I've heard a lot of people say he's the greatest high school wrestler ever. Take me through Jimmy Carr and why he got so good so fast.
Right. I don't even know if I could answer that, except for he just had a really, you know, his attitude was strong. And when he made up his mind to do something or even fight you, even get in a fight with you, I mean, you had to be ready. So he had that type of edge to him. And just really just, I think he really kept it simple. You know, hey, I'm faster than you. I guess if you can't stop me, you know, I'm taking you down. So he's taken down with guys that have family. He's taken down guys that are a lot older. And he just didn't let the physicality, he didn't let that stop him. He didn't let the fact that they had a family sitting in the stands, you know. he didn't let any of that stop him. He really just focused on taking you down and putting you on your back, whether it was on the sidewalk or mat, you know. And just a really good attitude. And he really did not take it easy on me. You know, so, I mean, pretty much I got beat up by all of my brothers that were a little older. And he just, and you know, he's your brother. So, I mean, I know he's tough. But I'm thinking, man, I can get this guy. But, I, you know, not till I got older did I realize how tough he really was, right? I mean, he just crushed me. And I would chase him around the room crying and saying to him, I'm going to take you down. And he would just shout at my brother Joe and say, Joe, tell him I'm not letting him take me down. And I'd just chase him around the room crying. And he would often remind me of that as well.
Well, you have an interesting family history with Fletcher and all of the Carr brothers.
Yeah.
Growing up in an environment like that, it's almost like you just have to get good or you're not going to survive.
Right.
Is that right?
That's true. I mean, they wanted me to win. They put a lot of effort and energy and talking to me about wrestling. And yeah, but it is a competitive, it was definitely a competitive family because I'm younger and I would go to these practices and man, I was just getting, again, tore up. I mean, one of the stories I used to motivate people is Jimmy came back from the Olympics and pretty much let me wear his Olympic uniform, to the tournament. And I talk about how powerful the uniform was. And literally because I had the uniform on, I got to the final. Because guys they just rolled over. I mean, they were like saying, no, that's Jimmy Carr, Joe Carr, Fletcher Carr. That's their brother. Man, look at that uniform. And the uniform and the history of my family pretty much scared the guys that I made it to the finals. The guy in the finals, though, didn't really go for the warm-up, though. So I ended up losing in the finals. But, yeah, Jimmy was just unbelievable. And to go back to your initial statement, he is definitely one of the greatest high school wrestlers ever. Because he made the Olympic team at 17, but he made the world team at 16, right? He made the world team at 16.
Man.
Senior level. And he plays sixth or something, I think.
And that's just crazy to me to think he was that good that early, and he's part of that legendary 1972 Olympic team with Gable and the Peterson brothers and Wayne Wells. Yeah. Did he talk about that experience much?
Yeah, I just think, I think that basically, I think they thought he was just too young. I mean, I don't even know if they wanted him on the team. You would have to ask Gable and the Petersons more, but I definitely got that sense, from my brother, that they just thought he was too young to be there. So they were definitely pulling for the older guys that they would have a better relationship with to make the team. Just think about that, right? I mean, this guy comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And so Jimmy was really good friends with Rick Sanders. So Rick Sanders liked Jimmy because he was fast like the Japanese wrestlers. And so they built a relationship. And, I don't know if that was the greatest guy for him to hook up with, because Rick Sanders was he was a wild guy. So,
Nate, you 100% know that I'm going to be asking you this question. There's no mystery. You know what's coming right now. You have to tell us about the rivalry, maybe the greatest rivalry in college wrestling history. I think it is better than Royce and Jackson, better than Freed and Brands. It's Nate Carr against Kenny Monday. You got to break it down for us and tell us what went on behind the scenes in those matches, dude.
The first time I wrestled Kenny, I think it must have been the Great Plains or something like that because they had that freestyle tournament then. And I want to say I was a sophomore. He's a freshman, and I wrestled him. And I think I might have won 9-1, something like that. And after the match, he pretty much told me, next time, I'm going to get you. And I was thinking, really? Okay. I mean, I had 9 points. You had one. Okay. But the next time we wrestled, he did beat me. How about that?
Man.
That's how competitive Kenny Monday is. And then that pretty much started the rivalry, and it's an understatement to say that Kenny Monday is definitely confident, and he's definitely one of the most successful wrestlers ever. I'm talking from grade school up. There's probably not a title that he has not won. Not all the champions hit, check every box when it comes to championships, but Kenny Monday is one that has checked every box. But, yeah, we got some fierce competition, some confrontations off the mat. And we just really, he wanted to win. I wanted to win. And then we did have some verbal confrontations. And I know he he beat pinned me in the Big H once, and I was thinking, and I'm trying to think if I had a win over him at that time or not, but, you know, basically I was telling him, you know, pretty much I was winning the match and I got caught, and his response was, yeah, I know I pinned you, but you were pinned before they even called it. And then, you know, and I was like, well, hey, let's go in it here in a couple weeks. He said, you know, of course he would say, you know, hey, I'm ready too, you know. So yeah, we
What kind of smack talk went on? What'd you guys say to each other in the locker rooms and when you saw each other? What kind of things got said?
I know for the last, I think the second one, and then, you know, maybe I had to have Kenny on the phone, but I know that for the second one, he beat me again, and I was having a great year too. And then he beat me in the Big Eights again, and I was not happy. And I don't know if I said something like, you know, well, you know what, it really counts is that match, you know, in a couple of weeks, that's the one that really counts. And I don't know if he was like saying something like, yeah, I'm getting it this time. I'm bringing my gun. I'm bringing my cannon. I don't know. We were just talking smack. And I think I might have said something. Well, okay, well, just don't forget that battery for your heart, you know. And we met in the finals again, and it was crazy. I thought he wrestled the match in Oklahoma. I thought he really wrestled well. And I did enough to come back, stay in the match, and end up winning in overtime. And yeah, he really wrestled well in Oklahoma City. And I remember he took a break during the match. And I remember saying to myself, either because he had a caution, one more caution, I'm going to get a point, which is going to tie the match up, and we go into overtime. Or I'll have to take him down. So when he took the break, that's what I was thinking to myself. Either I'm taking him down or he's getting called for stalling. And when he came back from the timeout, I literally just went crazy attacking him, and the ref called him, and we went overtime. And I never forget just dripping sweat, going back to the corner. Of course, Nichols is there. It seemed like Anderson was there. Willie Gatson was somewhere around. And Chris Campbell, I sit down in the chair, dripping sweat. And Chris Campbell says something like this. This is incredible. This is right where you want to be. This is amazing. And I was thinking, yeah, you're right. And what he was saying is, I had beat him in overtime the year before. And what Chris is saying, dude, this is incredible. This is right where you want to be. You got this match. And I went out and won 5-2 in overtime.
Didn't the moms get involved, though? Didn't they talk some smack, too?
Yeah, that was the other championship. When he had beat me in the Big Eight again. And I think it was like at an after gathering. And Willie Gatson was with me. Coach Gatson was with me, and Kenny was there. I think his mom was there, and she was basically telling me that, hey, my son's good. We're going to get you. We're going to get you this time. And she was pretty tough. Kenny's mom was pretty tough, so she was to say that she was convincing the understatement. She was like, hey, my son is going to get you. And I think Willie said something like, ma'am, I think your son should go another way. And that's kind of where it ended at.
Now, another guy wrestled internationally, Andre Metzger. Did you get up for him?
Yeah, Andre Metzger, I don't think he liked anybody he wrestled. So I don't think I got his blood pressure up as much as, you know, he wanted to win. And he's another guy that's super competitive. And, you know, Metzger was interesting. He invited me to work his camp. He had a camp, and he invited me to come. And I think he, of course, he's just going to scout me, right? And I kind of knew, you know, he was checking to see if I was going to go down to 49 or was I going to stay up at 63. And so he invited me to his camp, and he was like, hey, let's get a workout. I mean, we were trying to kill each other. We were bleeding. He was bleeding. I was bleeding. And we were just going at it. He was trying to break my limbs off of me. It was just us in this room going at it. And I remember throwing him one time, and I said, man, they should give me 10 for that. Oh, it pissed him off. And he just came just running after me, you know. But at the end of it, you know, he was trying to convince me, man, hey, you could be Chills, you could be Monday, you know. But if you come down, you'll have to wrestle me. I'm thinking, I just threw you all over the place. But anyways, so that's kind of the story there.
Now that you're back at Iowa State, one of the criticisms when they hired the staff, Kevin Dresser's from Iowa, Brent Metcalf's from Iowa, St. John is from Iowa. They didn't have any Iowa Staters. You're there. Do you feel like that took a little bit of the sting out of having an all Iowa staff?
Sure. You know, for me, I just look at, you know, we're here collectively to win, you know, and how about Gable left Iowa State, went to Iowa, helped them win. These guys coming here to Iowa State, it's just really about winning. You know, that's how I look at it.
Nate, how did this job present itself, and what does your role entail?
Well, basically, you know, the big thing now is that a lot of colleges have the RTC, and basically it's about, one, the RTC, you get to work with the high school guys and to get those guys ready for even dreaming, getting them starting to think, hey, I want to make an Olympic team. So I want to get good at freestyle. So it really opens that opportunity. And even for the getting littler guys too, if you have like a freestyle camp at the RTC. But basically you get to do that. And then you get to have guys that are training from the, you know, guys that have graduated and training for the Olympics or making a world team. You know, they get to work out with the college guys that also have that same dream or aspiration of making an Olympic or world team. And so it turns out to be a really unbelievable training tool, not only for the high school level, but also for the college guys to have guys that have graduated and they're still training. So you get that experience of just going down from those different levels, from the guys that have graduated in training to the college guys all the way down to the high school. And I think that's a great fit for the overall of making wrestling better in the country. And it looks like it. I mean, the U.S. is doing well.
What is Kevin Dresser's coaching style? You've had a few months to see it. How does he enter the practice room? What does he do that's right?
Well, definitely. I think he's put a good staff together. And for sure, you know, I've been around a lot of coaches, and for sure, Kevin Dresser is one of the hardest working coaches, from recruiting to going out and raising funds for the program. And basically, I think he's more of like the CEO that has, you know, a ton of experience. And so he teaches in the room, does an unbelievable job of teaching in the room. And then he lets, you know, his assistants, you know, run the practices as well, so that everybody's on the same page of, you know, producing champions. But he does a good job. Doesn't have a big ego. He's really about putting the best coach in the best position to help the wrestlers to be their best. And he just does. He does a nice job with that. Again, he's putting a nice staff together, and he's using his staff.
With your son, David, going to Iowa State, was that a good fit? Of course, he went there, so clearly he thought it was. But what was it about Iowa State, other than being the school that you attended, what was it that he liked about being there?
You know, when he came in the recruiting trip, you know, he really, really bonded with, you know, Coach St. John, and he liked Brett Metcalf, and, you know, I was a little bit surprised, but he really bonded. And I think what he saw is, you know, hey, my dad went here, my brother went here. I think when he came, he saw where he could win with that coaching staff here at Iowa State. I think that was the gist. And then I think his Christianity came in. I think he just really sensed that, you know, that this was a good place for him from a spiritual perspective, that you know, his relationship with Christ, I think also was a big part of that.
The last time Iowa State won the national championship as a team was 1987. Can Iowa State get back there, Nate?
Yes, they are definitely on their way. I mean, the jump that we're making right now, I think we're definitely going to be tougher next year. I think we'll just keep increasing, you know, when it comes to recruits. And this is a place where you can win. There's no doubt about it. This is a place where you can win, and that is our expectation here. That Dresser is here to win. Metcalf is here to win. St. John is here to win. And the team is here to win. And that's what we believe collectively. And Nate, so that's what it's about.
Nate, what does the future of the Cyclone RTC look like on the post-grad side?
Well, right now, you know, of course, you know, they had some guys here before I came, and I think that some of those guys have moved on, as well as some of even the college wrestlers. And so we're just building – we're building that program more now as we travel to look for other guys to bring in that are really a good fit for our program and for the guys that they're going to train with. So we'll still be out recruiting, not, you know, of course, Dresser and the team will be recruiting the college athletes, and then we'll be looking for post-grads to bring in. And so I think that's going to increase. Right now we have Kyvan Gaston is the big one, David. And so we're really just getting those guys ready to our college guys to go to that level. And we're looking for other guys to bring in as well.
Last week
we'll just keep building that.
We had Kevin Jackson on the program last week, and he said that when he was in high school, you were someone that he identified with, someone that he looked up to. Were you aware that you were influencing young African-American wrestlers while you were competing?
Yes. I, you know, just some of the stories I've heard for some of the wrestlers, like, you know, of course, Kevin shared that, Stuart Carter, Larry Jackson, Mike Van Arsdale, Bill Tate. I mean, you just go down the line, that those guys, you know, often, would share. McCall, you know, yeah, just a bunch of them. Just all of them have a little story where they're sharing, with me, I influenced them in some way or made them look at Iowa State. And even Tim Krieger, I don't know if you've asked Krieger, but Krieger, you know, one of the things he tells me, he said the reason I came to Iowa State was because of you, Nate. And Eric Volker also shares the same story.
What do you like about not only African Americans,
but just across the board, I guess.
Yeah, and so what do you like about what Jordan Burroughs is doing right now, not only for African-Americans, but just for the sport? It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, but he's just a great ambassador, right? You couldn't get a nicer guy, well-spoken. And you know what? When you look at him, you look at his family, you look at his kids. I mean, he's all about being a father. He's all about being a great husband. He's all about being a great leader and just a great man in general. And so on top of that, we throw a word that you know, everyone likes, and that's a champion. And so, yeah, Burroughs is awesome. Just a great spokesman for our sport and, you know, just a great guy. I mean, just everybody has to say that. Like, who hates him except for maybe some of the competitors? But, you know, that's normal. But what he represents, I mean – you can't help but like the guy because he's just a genuine, awesome champion on and off the mat.
As we head into the NCAA championships, we know that you won 3 titles. What do people need to know about what it takes to not only win one, but to win multiple championships?
Yeah, you know, you definitely have to... I think you have to be focused, and it's so intense that I think often what people forget is that they're drilling. If you're drilling, I always say, if you're drilling 500 high crotches, you need to have 2,000 positive mental thoughts. So you got to weather the storm mentally. I mean, it's an understatement that, you know, you know, the way you think is going to determine where you end up at. you know? And so I think that's huge. So you definitely have to be focused. You have to have those mental reps that you're encouraging yourself that you are going to win this championship. And I think you want to take it one match at a time, one man at a time, one move at a time, 1 minute at a time. And I think that's the best thing to do, to have that type of process that will lead you to the championship. And one of the things that I did after I, you know, my goal coming to college, by the way, was to graduate and then to win one national championship. So once I won as a sophomore, I just basically, my goal was to forget that I ever won. And I would say, man, I just really want to win the NCAA championship. So I acted like I never won. I did my best to forget that I won a championship and would get excited about winning a championship for the first time. That's how I did for my second championship. Just forgot that I won as a sophomore and just really dreamed, you know, how awesome it would be to win a championship. So that's one of the things I did my senior year. I wanted to win the championship, but the number one thing on my mind was that I didn't want to lose to Kenny Monday, and anybody could win the championship if I don't accept him. Except we were the best guys in the country, so. But that was pretty much my drive. Logan's Kenny Monday doesn't work.
So that helped you.
Yes, it definitely, definitely. I mean, I could run a couple sprints if I seen him getting his hand raised.
Hey, so. Iowa State's 197-pounder Willie Mikles just lost his father. How's he doing?
Yes, well, he has a lot of support. And, you know, I think Coach Dresser was saying, you know, because, of course, he talked to him a lot. He talked to the mom. But the mom was saying she really wants him to focus on the wrestling. And then when we come back as a team, Coach Dresser was saying that everybody's going to go, make sure they go to his home going and support the family. So he's in our prayers, and he has great teammates that are going to be there for him, really pushing him. So.
Tell us about Willie. What's he like as a person?
Well, he's a funny guy, and you know, he's really fallible. I mean, when you're around him, you like him. I mean, he's always helping his teammates out, and he's a hard worker, and you know, he's almost like a coach. He knows his wrestling. He has a ton of experience. And so he's almost like a wrestler coach slash coach. And so, but he's always encouraging the guys, always lifting them up. And definitely, if you ever talk to him, you know, before you leave his presence, you're probably going to laugh or smile because he's always saying something funny. But his teammates love him. The coaches love him. And so he's just a great addition. And for sure, everybody's, you know, they're really happy that he's at Iowa State.
Nate, we'll end with this. If you could pick anyone, past, present, future, that you could launch in a throw, who would that person be?
Wow. you're asking me, who would I want to throw?
Yeah, and you've thrown a lot of people. You've thrown some people who haven't landed yet.
Yeah, I really don't know. I mean, I don't have anyone that come to mind. You know, back in the day, I mean, if I picked somebody, it'd probably be Kenny Monday Artson Fazayev. So,
Nate, when's the last time you competed against Kenny in anything, and what was it?
Geez, I mean, just the wrestling. We're just good friends now. We really bonded. Of course, we trained together, you know, for that 88 team. And he's just a great guy, great father. And we often get together over the summer in Pittsburgh with a friend of mine at his camp. And we work together there, and our sons come. So Kenny's boys are there, and David's there. And, you know, it's a good time. We all get along and all try to help each other. So, but he's a great guy and for sure a great champion.
You gave the eulogy at Willie Gadsden's funeral. Have you ever seen anything like that over at Waterloo East High School? I mean, people were just coming out of the woodworks that knew Willie. That was an incredible day.
It was, and what an honor for me, a joy for me to do that for a coach, a mentor, a guy that has just poured into my life. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but he was the best man in my wedding.
I didn't know that. No, didn't know it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, so we were really close, so close to this day that there's not a time when I see his son, Kyvin Gadsden, that he doesn't call me Uncle Nate.
Hmm.
So, man, I love Willie Gadsden, and part of the reason I was a champion is because I had a guy like that in my corner, both on and off the mat. And, man, did he love wrestling. And so it was just an honor for me to also have, you know, I had the opportunity of leading him to Christ as well. And so, yeah, just a great individual, great family. And Kyvin Gadsden is working hard, and he's doing great things, carrying on that Gadsden name. Of course, Willie had a brother, Charlie, and I'm just really close. Those guys were like my uncles when I was in college. And so picking Iowa State, you know, when I came and picked Iowa State, having yet both Charlie and Willie Gadsden and Chris Campbell, unbelievable. Those guys trained me so well that I was ready to go through a brick wall. So imagine that's really behind the scenes of my wrestling. Those guys taking the time to help me be a good young man and to train me to be a champion. Willie Gadsden, Charlie Gadsden, Coach Nichols, Les Anderson. How do you beat that for a backdrop? And so I was definitely, it's an understatement to say that I was very fortunate.
How do you beat Nate Carr? He's a legend, three-time NCAA champion, Olympic bronze medalist. Thank you for spending this time on the mat with us. We can't wait to see you out in Pittsburgh this year.
Yeah, looking forward. Boy, and what a championship that's going to be. Man, be a lot of tears and some great wrestling, great intensity, great. You're going to see hearts just going all out. So, and Kyle, thank you for what you do and for you giving back to wrestling, and Andy, and really just appreciate every time you call me, I'm smiling as soon as I hear your voice. So I really appreciate everything that you do and using your talents to just take this great sport of ours to a different level. So
thank you, Nate.
Off to you.
And there's a 50% chance I'll never ask you about Kenny Monday again.
Okay, yeah.
All right. And that's the 50% that that I won't probably won't win. Okay.
Oh, that's funny.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. We will see you out in Pittsburgh, PA. All the best as you go to the Big 12 Championships with Iowa State.
Thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it. God bless.
That was Nate Carr, three-time NCAA champion, a legend in our sport. Andy, as we close this out, we go into championship season for Division III, Division II, Division I. We have conference. This is the time of year, man. It's March.
It's awesome.
And it's going to blow by so fast, but it's fun to be in the thick of this and get insight from someone that won it. And I really, looking back at what Nate said there when he said he erased the memory of winning one championship and said, I just want the one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone put it the way that he put it. I think probably people do that in order to compartmentalize it. But the way he clarified it and said, I just tried to erase that memory and just focus on that one. I liked how he articulated that.
Pretty fascinating stuff there on a lot of different fronts, right?
Sure was.
That he was in his mind heading to Iowa.
I didn't know that either.
No, neither did I. And his mom has a couple dreams about it, about him at Iowa State.
Yeah. How many people do you think we'll talk to in 20 years that will say that about Penn State? Say, I wanted to go to Penn State, but it didn't work out. They had Nolf, they had Rutherford there, so I had to go to X University.
I don't know. know.
I don't know if that's the narrative anymore. I don't know if that happens as much.
Yeah, they're just, it seems like, obviously, Kale is and his staff are doing an unbelievable job there, and they're dominating on the recruiting scene, as well as what they're getting the results on the mat as well. But the thing is like here in the last 20 years, we've seen so many different schools that have been able to produce national champions. And it seemed like, I don't know, at least in my mind, 30, 40 years ago, we didn't see that as much. We saw Iowa, Oklahoma State, Iowa State, Oklahoma, back in the early 80s, and then a few more that would come on the scene later in the decade, Arizona State. But it seems like guys are winning it at schools we never imagined that they would. And that started probably about 20 years ago. Jesse Jansen winning it at Harvard. I think that was big for a lot of schools around the country to see that you can go places that are not traditional wrestling powers and still get it done.
And I think there's an element too that if you don't like the school you're at right now, you transfer. So I think there's probably not going to be a lot of guys with regret, because I think they're going to find a way to the school that they want to be attending. So I think that narrative probably won't be as prevalent in 10 to 20 years when we talk to these guys and have a time to reflect on what happened in their careers. But it's interesting that you think of all the guys that have said that, and I'm sure you've heard that numerous times, that I wanted to go to Iowa. A guy was at my weight class, so I had to go somewhere else. And Nate Carr was a guy that surprised me. I thought he was always on board with Iowa State. So to know that he was wanting to go to the University of Iowa, that really did surprise me.
Well, and it's different now too, that social media and the lines of communication are more open than ever before. Probably back in that time, if a coach wasn't calling you, you probably weren't getting contacted by that school, would be my guess.
I think that's absolutely right. How else would you know about it? They absolutely know social media, so you had to wait for that landline to call or a letter. And I think that was probably the archaic way of getting in the door of a recruit, or going to a wedding, like Coach Nichols did. You did whatever it took to get the door open. This has been fun. Thanks to Jacob Casper for another Casper's Corner. We'll do a live Casper's Corner at the NCAA Championships in Pittsburgh. So be sure to tune into our podcast that we're going to do on the Wednesday before the Division I NCAA Championships. Thanks to Nate Carr for being on the program. As always, thanks to Andy Hamilton of TrackWrestling.com. I'm Kyle Klingman. You've been listening to On the Mat.
This show is part of the Mat Talk Podcast Network.
For more wrestling podcasts, head over to MattTalkOnline.com.